Good morning, everyone. Everyone's on me. Your understanding of the Dhamma helps you to be okay with anything. You know, we have hot days and nice days, sunny days and rainy days, cloudy days, gloomy days, warm days, good days and bad days. There are other days you have in your calendars, but I can't say them out loud on a sermon. The words in which you describe your days. But whatever the day is, inside you should be cool with that. That is what the Dhamma helps us do. It's possible. And I think most of you will be experiencing that too, more or less an extent. You're beginning to experience, hopefully, that even when the ups and downs of life come your way, you are unperturbed, undisturbed. You are cool. You are okay with anything. And that is the victory that the Dhamma brings you. See, this is a victory that cannot be taken away from you. Every other victory is very transient. Today it's yours, tomorrow it's someone else snatches it from you. But this is a victory that once you have it, it's yours for the keeping. Do you see how sometimes young people, they make it their life's purpose to get into a relationship with someone else? For a young man, sometimes perhaps, you know, the purpose of their life can be, at least a few years of their life can be, to get into a relationship with someone that has taken their fancy, someone that has stolen their heart. And then from that point on, everything he does, every word he says, every thought that passes his mind is about that special person and how I can be with that person and how I can get that person to want to be with me. And then they spend days, weeks, months, sometimes years, sometimes a whole lifetime. You all watch films, haven't you? Have you not seen how sometimes people spend an entire lifetime trying to be with this special someone because one day they fell in love with them and then they thought their happiness is dependent on that other person being with them? And then from there on, the purpose of their life is to acquire the object or the person of their desire. Unfortunately, they're never happy. Even on the day that they acquire what it is that they want, the person they want, they're not truly happy because from then on they have to live in fear. Fear and grief are the two things that people who want anything have to live in. This is the undeniable truth of this world, folks, and that is why we need an alternative. I hope you have come to a point in life where you have realized that you need an alternative. Whatever truths you have settled for so far, they don't seem to work. Let's be honest. Most of you are highly educated people in society. Most people would give their right arm to have a good education, as good an education as you do. Most of you are very educated people in society, but you're still not happy. So what was the point of that education? Education does not equal happiness. Wealth does not equal happiness. Most of you are well-to-do. I assume. I could be wrong, but I assume. But that does not equate happiness. Most of you have families, a big family, but that does not equate to happiness. Happiness should be redefined. And if you get that wrong, you have to live a life of misery. Unfortunately, you know, people are experts in everything else. How do you send a man to the moon? There are books written on that. There are experiments conducted on that, and finally they have sent man to the moon many times and many years ago. People know how to do these things. They know how to submerge into the great depths of the oceans. That they have mastered the art of. They know how to make money. They even know how to invent virtual money. This is how good man is, how intelligent man is. But unfortunately, when it comes to happiness, they've lost the plot. It's funny, isn't it? How something so simple has escaped us. I mean, you know, it's not a big thing. It's just, we just want to be happy. We just want to be happy. Is that too much to ask for? Just want to be happy. But alas, that one simple thing has escaped us. It doesn't come in boxes. It doesn't come in packages. It doesn't come in bottles. It doesn't come in anything. It is all within. That is what people don't understand. There are some who claim they know that that happiness is within, but they don't know how to find it. They don't know how to surface that happiness. Because here's the problem. They don't realize that eradication of attachment is what leads to happiness. And that is why we need the Buddha in our lives. It is only a Buddha who comes into this world and teaches us that the only path to happiness is in the cessation of attachment and no other way. Ekayano ayam bhikkave maggo sattanang visuddhiya. You might wonder, what is visuddhiya? In simple terms, it is happiness. The purification of the mind. In simple terms, happiness. Soka pariddhavanang samatikkamaya. How do you be free of grief and lamentation? Dukkha domanasanang attangamaya. How do you exceed unsatisfactoriness and discontentment? Nyayasa adhigamaya. How do you achieve and attain to a higher wisdom? Nibbanasa sachikiriyaya. How do you attain ultimate bliss? Yajjan sattaro satipatthana. The only way to do that is the satara satipatthana. In other words, understanding the truth, what the satara satipatthana does is to help you free yourself from attachment. Attachment to feelings, attachment to rupa, attachment to consciousness, and attachment to all dhamma. In summary, freedom from attachment. That is what we are here to do. So, today we have another opportunity to make progress on that journey. And it's great to see also some new faces in the audience. You must be thankful to those who have invited you to come here, which is something that we always cherish and we always encourage and we are always very grateful for. Today, as I was waiting there in the waiting lounge for the sermon to start, I was looking at all the children who had come in to take exams this morning. And I was thinking to myself, hopefully one day I can talk to them. Young children. Maybe, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10. Young children. These are children who have come into this world looking for happiness, nothing more. They didn't come into this world to learn science. Not to learn math. Not geography. Or history. You didn't even know such things existed, right? Until you walked into this world. We didn't know that science existed. But we all came into this world looking for one thing, and that was happiness. But the truth of the matter is, what they learn at school does not give them happiness. It might help them make money. It might help them do a job. It might help them start up a business. Right? That they'll little help them do. But it won't give them happiness. Because happiness comes from within. And that is purely from the eradication of attachment. There is not a course outside Buddhist philosophy that teaches you how to cease attachment in the mind. That can only be taught and learned through Buddhist philosophy. And that is what we are here to do. So let us bring our palms together in veneration then, as we make a start to today's proceedings. To be grateful for the great master, to the great master who made every effort to deliver us the path to cessation of attachment, the path to cessation of suffering. His infinite wisdom is what we celebrate. His infinite compassion is what we celebrate. Let us take this moment to pay homage to the Lord Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, let us also take this opportunity to remind ourselves why we are here and to renew our pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem and the ultimate path that leads us to happiness everlasting. Let us also take a moment to observe the precepts and make a start to today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Members of the Mahasangha, Silmani and Mahansa, and our dearest and loyal devotees. See, when people are hot, right, they have the common sense to put on a hat. They have the common sense to go indoors. They have the common sense to take shelter. They have the common sense to invent a piece of equipment, an appliance that gives them cool wind, a fan, an aircon. People have the common sense to do that when they're feeling hot. But when their mind heats up, they don't know what to do. How many years of evolution have we gone through now? You know, some people deny the fact that we've evolved from monkeys, right? And some say yes we have, others say we haven't. That's besides the point. We've been human beings just the way we are, Homo sapiens sapiens, for the last 300,000 years at the very least. Right? And over that period of time, we have become so advanced in finding solutions to the problems that we have faced. The adversities of life that come our way, we have evolved to find solutions to those problems. It strikes me as bizarre that where the problem is a physical problem, we've always come up with the right answer. Don't you think so? I mean, look at how advanced this building is, for instance. How many stories is this? Five or six. Six stories. It's a six-story building. And if you include the ground floor, if I remember on the list, there were five numbers, so including ground floor, there's six stories. Look at, this is a marvel of engineering. The fact that, you know, we've been able to build high-rise buildings. Can you see those buildings on the other side? Just outside there, either side of you. If you look out the window, some of those buildings are maybe 30 stories high. You know, people needed space to live. And everything was getting very cluttered. There were more people and less space to live in, so what did people do? They wrecked their minds, right? And they came up with a solution to a problem. And what fantastic solutions they are. In a small amount of space, we have created more space. It's brilliant, I think. We have fans that use one form of energy to convert just air to wind. We have been able to transfer energy from one place to another. And we thought only God could do that. But now we are able to do that. You know, the electricity that we consume here is generated many thousands of kilometers away, at least hundreds of kilometers away. If you're using solar energy, where is that energy created? Many millions of kilometers away. Look at how we have managed to harness the powers of nature to relieve ourselves from suffering. It strikes me, honestly, how we have been so advanced as a species to free ourselves from only one half of the problems that bother us. the physical problem. But when it comes to the mental problem, the psychological pressures that we have, the stresses and the anxieties, we still don't have answers. Scientists don't have answers to these things. When you are angry, take a walk. That is not an answer. What if you take a walk and you bump into someone you really don't like? That's not an answer. For all the merits that people have, right, they've not come across the teachings of the Buddha. Put the Buddha to aside, a teaching that helps them to free themselves from suffering. And even in an era where we live in, where the Buddha's teaching is so readily available, it's out there. Now it's on the internet, it's on the radio, it's on the podcasts, it's out there, it's in books, it's in these sermons, it's everywhere. But yet, look at how many people, how many thousands, if not millions and hundreds of thousands of people are still struggling with the day-to-day pressures of life. The suicide rate is going up by the day. Every year you take, look at the statistics, suicide rate just keeps going up. But people have more. Things are in abundance. Right? Man's intelligence keeps on advancing in such a way that he's able to harness the forces of nature, the elements of nature, and convert them into a productive manner. Today we are able to use water from the sea and purify that and make it consumable. Today we are able to harness the wind and generate electricity out of that. Today we are able to harness sunlight and create energy out of that. Look at all the things we've been able to do. We dig the earth, get the soil out of the earth, and make things out of it. Appliances, utensils, and equipment that help us to live a more comfortable life. Despite all that, people still suffer no end. See, there has to come a point in our lives, ladies and gentlemen, don't you think? Or at least for humanity, where they begin to understand and realize, or self-realize, that all of these things that they're doing are not really taking them anywhere. We're just going round in circles. It's like a dog chasing its own tail. One thing after the other, after the other, after the other. We keep ourselves busy. That's what we do. People are far busier than they used to be. You know, just think about your own lives. Your grandfather, your grandmother, if you go back two generations, they were home more of the time than you are. In today's day and age, although we have built for ourselves mansions, you know, back then they had small houses. Yes, they might have had a bungalow, you know, they had bungalows back then, but that was not for two people. The children married and they stayed at home. Their children married and they also stayed at home. That's why we call it the Mahagendra. That's how it used to be, but now it's not so. Today, the sizes of the houses get bigger, but the number of people in them get smaller. So there's more square footage per person. So we have in abundance the materialistic things that we believe may give us a comfortable life, physically, yes, but they have not brought us any closer to mental happiness. I think we have missed the trick. We have missed the trick, and yet we call ourselves intelligence, an intelligent species. You see, take an animal. Now your dog at home, right? If you have a pet dog at home, let's say you've had the dog for 10 years. Okay, over the last 10 years, how much has your dog advanced? So when you first brought your dog, right, it ate off the floor. How does it eat now? Cutlery? Knife and fork? No. Right, when you first brought your dog home, it slept in its kennel. You made one and it slept there. Right? If you hadn't won, then you would have slept on the carpet, right? At home somewhere. And if you're watching this online, then by the fireplace. Where does it sleep now? It's still in the kennel, same place. And when it wants to mate, does it take a wedding? No, it just goes looking for a partner. Once it finds a suitable partner, they mate. Right? That's it. They don't need to go on honeymoon. Right? They don't book themselves a resort somewhere where they go and spend 2 or 3 weeks. Right? They don't invite their friends and throw a party. Your dog doesn't do that. So don't you think your dog, right? Let's just put it this way. Your dog has realized that those things don't bring it happiness. Sorry. So therefore, your dog is content with what it's given to eat, with where it's given to sleep, with the partner that it's given to mate with. Your dog is content. But on the other hand, look at its owner. How did you first start eating? Remember when you first left home? You were at home, right? At the beginning, you were at home with your parents, right? Then they served you food on a plate, right? And maybe your mother fed you, right? But then later on, you realize, no, this home-cooked meals, they're no good. From time to time, we need something different. We need some variety. But then you couldn't go out as, you know, to your will because you were reliant and at the mercy of your parents. So when they chose and decided to take you out to a restaurant, then you would do. But then you thought, well, why like this? If I can grow up quicker and become an adult, then I can make my own choices. Isn't that why we all want to become adults? Sooner rather than later? Because we can make our own choices, right? And then we are not at the mercy of our parents and our elders who tell us what to do and what not to do. So we want to grow up and become adults. Only after you become one, you realize, bad choice. Can we go back to being kids again? So then anyhow, you grew up. And then today, simply eating your home-cooked meal doesn't make you happy. But just think about what you feed Tommy at home. You take some rice from the rice pot. I remember how we used to, my dad loved dogs. So at home, what we used to do was we had the rice and dad used to make some, what do you call them, sprats for the dogs. That's what they always got fed, sprats. Okay? Palmeso? Yeah? So that's what they always got fed. From time to time, he would bring some chicken liver or something like that. But it was one or the other. That was it. They didn't have cheesecake. They didn't have sticky toffee pudding. They didn't have pizzas. They didn't have any of that. It was one or the other. Either sprats or liver. And guess what? The dogs were always happy with that. They never demanded more. They never protested. They never said, can we have a treat today? Can we go out today? Can we order in something today? Never demanded. Do you know why that was? You know, come to think of it, now I understand why. They knew. They knew something that you don't. They knew that food does not bring them happiness. How does that make you feel? Proud? And our dogs, they always slept in the kennel. And you know what? Even if the kennel was dirty, they never came and demanded, wash it for me. Never said that. We had to remind ourselves to do that. So we had at home, my brother used to do it on occasions and I used to do it on the other occasions. Right? So we had split it up between ourselves, that duty of cleaning the kennel, and we used to do that. But they never demanded. The dogs never demanded. But how about you? How many days can you sleep on a mattress? Just a thin mattress. What do you have at home today? And when people feel like, you know, when as technology advances, right, the number of layers on the mattress advances, right? Today, you have mattresses as thick as the bed, don't you? But our dogs, they sleep on the floor. Perhaps they have realized that happiness does not come in the mattresses they sleep. They don't ask for a pillow. But how comfortable must your pillow be? And you're not happy with just any old pillow, right? From time to time you go and get a new pillow. From time to time you go and see what other technology, what the advancements they have made in pillow technology. I mean, even a pillow is very sophisticated technology these days, don't you think so? Yeah. You only need it until you fall asleep, but then still, you want the best. They never complain about the color that the kennels were painted. They were not painted at all. They were not painted. And the dogs were happy with that. But just look at human beings. They are not. From time to time, they might even want to change the color. If it's a shade of light green today, then maybe they want light blue the next day. New Year came and went. Perhaps some of you repainted your walls. Maybe you were in for a different color. And when it's New Year, the dogs never ask for New Year gifts. What about the situation at home? Everyone got given a new shirt, a new dress, something new for the New Year. But the dogs never ask for it. What about birthdays? Do your dogs ever come up to you and say, "It's my birthday tomorrow, what am I going to get?" They don't. But human beings, you know the drill. See, does it not make you wonder, if we have actually advanced ourselves spiritually and our intelligence, we still seem to think, folks, that happiness comes to us from the outside world. What a terrible situation to be in. We still seem to think that the dress that we wear brings us happiness. The food that we eat brings us happiness. The music that we listen to brings us happiness. What we see with our eyes brings us happiness. We still seem to think that 300,000 years on. When are we going to learn? When are we going to learn what a dog knows from birth? Is it fair for us to say that we are the more advanced, more intelligent species? Is it? Think about it. Is it? Is what you see around you evidence that we are a more intelligent species? Today we have satellites that orbit the Earth, right, that help us communicate. I understand, you know, these are all advances in technology that have made life convenient for us. Yeah? It is because you want to speak to someone on the other side of the Earth, you need the satellite up there. If you didn't want that, then the satellite need not be there. Of course, I understand that, you know, when there are natural disasters, we have to, you know, our technology helps us to save lives. And all that is good. Yes, that much I get. But that's not the only reason satellites are up there. In fact, the pornography industry is why you get your internet connection so cheap. Second up is the gambling industry. If it weren't for these two industries, you would not be able to afford an internet connection. Because it's highly subsidized by these two industries. Because they pay for the most of the infrastructure. Just because you want an internet connection doesn't mean that the government, the state is going to lay down fiber cables, right, across the oceans and draw wires across the streets and give you an internet line. But someone else is footing the cost. And who is that? The pornography industry and the gambling industry. These are the two industries that consume most of internet traffic. Ever seen your dog watching pornography? But you remember the last time you walked into your son's room and he quickly shut off his web browser? I ask you again, what is the measure of how intelligent we are? Just think about it for a second. What is the true measure of how intelligent we are? Is it right that we measure ourselves with the promptness, the quickness with which we are able to get what we want, invent what we want, and acquire what we want? Is that the true measure of our intelligence? Or should it be something else, I ask you? Should it not be our ability to actually sift through all the wantings and the desires that come into our mind and ask ourselves the question, why do I actually want this? Is it something I really want? Does happiness actually come from this? Or is it merely my ignorance? Should that not be our wisdom? Should that not be our intelligence? Should that not be the measure with which we validate how wise we are? But it is not, because that is not what we have learned. From our very formative years, from our school education, from whatever we've learned growing up, we have always learned one thing, and that we have learned well. And what is that? If you want something, here's how you can go get it. Isn't the entire premise of education based on that foundation? You tell me. If you want something, here's how you can go get it. That's what education is about. Buddhist philosophy is 180 degrees on the other side. Here's what Buddhist philosophy says. If you want something, here's how to rid your mind of wanting it. Do you see the difference between the two? What's education again? If you want something, here's how you can go get it. Buddhist philosophy is, if you want something, here's how you can work on ridding yourself, eradicating that wanting. One leads you to misery, the other leads you to happiness. Because you see, when you want something, ladies and gentlemen, remember the other day we drew it on the board. I'll put it up on the board again. Have you done your homework, by the way? When you believe that there's an object that brings you happiness, we call that ignorance. I call it ignorance, I don't know what you call it. I call it ignorance, and I'm going to help you understand why I call it ignorance. Now, you know what ignorance is. Ignorance is when you don't know something, when you don't know right from wrong. That is when we say, that is what we refer to as ignorance. When you don't know right from wrong. So, I propose to you that when you believe that happiness comes from an object, that is ignorance. If you and I are in the same school of thought, then you and I can agree on this point. If you and I disagree, that's because you believe, no, happiness does come from these objects, Swaminathan. That's why we try and keep ourselves with these objects. That's why we associate with these objects. How can you say that happiness does not come from these objects? But these sermons are to help you understand that. Is to help prove that point, that happiness does not come from the outside world. It does not come from the association of material things. It does not come from sights, sounds, smells, taste, and touch. It does not come from them. So happiness is not something that someone can gift you. They can't put it in a wrapper and give you. Here you go. It's not something that someone can serve you on a tray. It's not. But when you go to a hotel and the waiter comes in and he asks you, what can I get for you, sir? Aren't you happy? And they give you the menu card. You know, does it not give you a sense of joy just going through the menu card, finger walking that and going through it? Today, let's see, I'm going to have... just recall one or two memories of having done something recently and going out and, picking whatever you want to eat from the menu card. And then when you say, I'd like to have this, and you pick something off the menu. And they say, I'll be right back, sir. And then they walk away. See, now waiting for your order, that's not fun. That's not fun. Because how do you know that's not fun? Of course, right? If they'll say, I'll be back in a minute. They went away 5 minutes ago. And they said they'll be back in a minute. Now you're watching the clock. And now it's 10 minutes. Are you still happy? No. So what does that tell you? Waiting is not happiness. Why is waiting for something, not a source of happiness for you? Here's why. Because you believe the object is what gives you happiness. If the object is what gives you happiness, then waiting for that object cannot bring you happiness, surely. See? If I can convince you that this gives you happiness, okay? Now you're not happy. Now you're happy. Now you're not happy. And then I tell you, I'm going to show this pen to you in a little while. Just imagine you really believe that this pen brings you happiness. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to give you happiness in a little while. Now I've got it hidden. And then I say, at the count of three, one, two, three. No, I'm not going to show you. Now you said, stop teasing us, Swaminathan. You don't like to be teased because it's vexing you. The reason for this, ladies and gentlemen, is because you believe the object brings you happiness. That's why you open your eyes and you wait for that moment I show you the pen. You keep your eyes wide open, hoping that I'm going to show you the pen anytime now. That's what happens when you're at the restaurant. That's what happens when you're at the hotel. And the waiter says, I'll be back in a minute. And then you see the waiter appearing. They're walking out of the kitchen with some food plates in their hands, right? And now you prepare yourself. Your tummy is preparing itself. Your mouth is preparing itself, right? You're having a conversation now. You say, right, he's here. They're bringing the food now. And they walk up to a different table. Not happened to you? Yes. How does that make you feel? Vexed. Why? Because what brings you happiness? The object brings you happiness. Object in this case is the food. See, don't you see how you have given over the keys of your happiness to someone else? Oh, here's a question, right? Something you can relate to. Now, in today's day and age, most women, they can drive. Right? That's good. We like that. But if you go back a few decades, right, women didn't drive. They were driven by their other house. So it was only the husband who could drive. If you go back a few years, a few decades, it was so. But today, not so. Everyone can drive, and that's fine. That's great. It's a convenience. Great that everyone can. So, now, if you take there was a time my mother couldn't drive. So she had to take lessons, driving lessons, when we went to the UK, because she had to get to work all by herself, so she had to learn to drive. But there was a time where she couldn't drive. And then, whenever she needed to be taken out to do some shopping or to go to see her friends, she had to wait for either my father or myself to drive her to her desired destination. She had given us, my father and I, even if she had the car, even if she was the one who owned the car, because she couldn't drive, she was at our mercy. Wasn't she? So we had the keys to make her happy or make her equally unhappy. Just imagine if she'd upset us. Let's say the weekend is when she goes out. Right? So on Saturdays, let's say she goes out to see her friends. On Sunday, she goes out to the shopping. Right? On Friday, she has to spend very carefully, don't you think? She's got to be very careful on Friday because the weekend's coming up, and if she upsets me or my father, she ain't going to get round. Because she had given us the key to her happiness. And then she took driving lessons later on, and then she was at no one's mercy. She had become independent. Then, whenever she wanted to drive, she could drive. Once again, we have the intelligence to do that. We have the intelligence to do that. We want to get around, we find out how to get around, we get ourselves a car, we get ourselves driving lessons, and we earn ourselves our independence. Independence of mobility, that's what we earn for ourselves. But what about the independence of happiness? That we so freely divest. We so freely delegate. We so freely hand over to other people. Now the waiter at the restaurant, the waiter who you've never met before, you don't even know them by their first name, you've handed over to them your happiness. See how willing you are to give up the keys to your happiness to someone else who you don't even know? All because of one reason. All because of one thing, and that's because you think happiness is on the object. Do you all understand what I mean by object here? It's anything that can be seen, anything that can be heard, anything that can be smelt or tasted, anything that can be touched. There's also another one, anything that can be thought. That is why when you try to recall something and you can't, what happens to you? You see someone on the street, he's a friend from 10 years ago from school. Right? And they call you, they address you by your name. And for the love of God, you can't remember theirs. Now, it's a very embarrassing moment, isn't it? You say, hello, hi. Nice to meet you. So good to see you after so many years. Been there, done that? Yes. Does it not vex you in those moments? Yes. Only because you believe that happiness comes in an object. In this moment, it is a thought object. There are sight objects, there are sound objects, smell objects, taste objects, touch objects, and thought objects. That's why when you try to remember something and you can't, you go, what's that thing? You know that thing? That... What's all the sound effects for? Are you showing your happiness there? No, you're showing your unhappiness, your unsatisfactoriness, you're showing your disappointment. This is a display of vexation. Because you want something and you can't have it. And that something you think brings you happiness. That's why. This is what ignorance is. Whenever you believe that happiness comes in from the outside, by outside, remember I also include the thoughts here, okay? Because you might wonder when you say outside, are you just talking about the outside world, material objects? Not just those things, even your thoughts. Meaning it is not within. What I'm really trying to say is, you believe that happiness is something you have to earn. It has to come to you. It has to be acquired, whereas it isn't. When your quest for happiness stops, that's when you're happy. I like to use the analogy of someone trying to listen to the sound of silence. We've spoken about this before. I don't think here it was at the monastery on a Saturday sermon. Just imagine if someone wanted to listen to the sound of silence. What would they have to do? Someone wants to listen to the sound of silence. I imagine they don't know what silence is. Right? So we are talking about, this is a hypothetical situation. There's a man who doesn't know what silence is. Okay? They don't know what silence is. So they walk up to you and say, hey, mister, I've heard this thing called silence. What is it? So now you have to explain to them. What would you say? They want to listen to silence. They want to hear silence. So what would you do? Here's what you'd do. You'd say, that. Oh, that is silence. You mean that. You say, yeah, that. Ah, okay. So then you ask them to repeat silence, they go, that. Now they think that is silence. How do you give someone an example of silence if they don't know what silence is? Now just imagine they go around looking for silence. They go searching on the internet. What is silence? Let me listen to silence. And they click on something. It's a song. That's not silence. Ask someone, is there silence? That's not silence. They walk out. They go to the garden. Where is silence? There's no silence there. See, a man who's looking for the sound of silence is never going to be content, because he thinks silence is something that has to be heard. You get me what I'm saying? He thinks silence is something that you can hear. But is silence something that you can hear? No, silence is when you're not hearing anything. It's the same thing when it comes to happiness. Happiness is not something that you find by doing something. Happiness is what you have when you stop doing everything. By everything, I don't mean like everything, okay? Because then you might wonder, well, is a Rahatan Mohanse not happy then? Because he does things. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, when people believe that happiness is something that has to be built, that has to be constructed, fabricated, engineered, right? Then they get into this quest. They're on a quest to build happiness. This is what we call Abhisankara. The mind trying to make happiness, create happiness, because you believe happiness comes from the outside world. Ignorance is a real plight. It's a real curse. If you ask me what's worse, cancer or ignorance? No question about that. It's ignorance. Because even if you have a cancer that cannot be healed, right, when you're dead, that's it. But ignorance? That's why the Buddha comes into this world to deliver us from ignorance, not from cancer. Otherwise you might wonder, you know, Swami Nuhansa, you are so compassionate. At least we think you are. Right? Why don't you go around? Why don't you go and find a cure for cancer? Why don't you do that? If you love humanity as much as you say you do, if you care so much about all human beings as much as you say you do, right? If you really mean it when you say that you think of all of us as mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and friends, and we are all one people, one nation, right? We are all one, we are all in this together. Why don't you go and find a solution to these problems that bother us all? Why don't you go looking for a solution to poverty? Why don't you go looking for a solution to cancer? Why don't you go looking for a solution to child abuse? Why don't you go looking for solutions to these things? Why are you just, you know, eating the food that we offer you, sitting yourselves down in the monastery, sitting in meditation, doing sermons and talking about ignorance, ignorance, ignorance? Is that all you know? Is that all you want to do? Why don't you go do something more meaningful? One might ask. That's only because they don't realize the root cause of all problems is in ignorance. Here's the root cause. Because from ignorance stems everything else. You know why people are poor? Why are people poor? Why is there poverty in this world? Because of ignorance. Even on a mundane level, it's because people don't understand that a poor man is a poor man who has a poor man's mindset. In other words, when someone does not understand that to be rich they have to give, that is ignorance. So therefore they are poor. So by educating them, charity, generosity, the value of giving, you can lift them out of poverty. But that's on a mundane level. On a supramundane level, one is laukika, the other is lokottara. You are poor because you are born. That if you weren't born, you wouldn't be poor. And in another way, you are only poor Because there's something you want that you don't have. Don't you think so? How do you define poverty? When you can't have what you want. You're happiness poor because you want happiness. I'm money poor. I used to be, but today I don't want money. If there's something you want in this world and you don't have it, that's when you're poor. So if you can free people from wanting, then they are no longer poor. Because poverty, I don't mean the conventional definition of poverty, I mean a more profound definition of poverty, is a state where you can't have or you don't have what you want. So if you can take away the wanting, then you take away poverty as well. Come back to this now. We are talking about ignorance. So I asked you over the course of the last week to think of 5 examples where you experience pleasure, and I asked you to think for yourselves whether there was not a moment of pain prior to that. If there was not a moment of displeasure, a moment of vexation before that, which you had to come out of, relieve yourself from, so that you could experience that pleasure. And I hope you did that. Because I would have given you a glimpse into this pleasure that you experience on a daily basis, day in, day out. I need you to fall out of love with pleasure. That's the first thing that needs to happen. You know, just because you listen to a sermon doesn't mean you're going to stop experiencing pleasure full stop. The first thing that needs to happen is you need to fall out of love with pleasure. You have a love affair with pleasure, honestly. We all do. This love affair with pleasure has to stop first. So much so that when you feel pleasure, you're not happy about it. Right now, when you experience pleasure, aren't you happy about that? I can see a few nods in the room this way, some this way, and that's good, right? Because we are making a transformation. At least you know now that when you experience pleasure, that's not something to celebrate. But go back a few months, weeks, years before you started listening to the Dhamma. When there were moments of in life where you experienced pleasure, were you not really pleased with yourself, the fact that you can enjoy, life is good? Have you never said those things? Right? You go on a trip, right? Maybe you go to Hantana, right? You stand out there, you look at the openness, right? Or you stand by the waterfall, you look out there and you think, wow, life is good. Look at this, life is good. You go to see the Dunghinda Falls, right? You see the Bamarakanda Falls, and you look at the Ulumu Falls and you go, life is good. This is wonderful. In fact, on the way back to the monastery, most Sundays, we have this. Most Sundays on the way back to the monastery, there's a stream. If you, on your way to the monastery, you would have seen that, right? There's a stream and people come and spend their Sunday afternoons there. So on the way back, I have this little chat with the Anagarika Mahathas. And you know, we take a moment to contemplate on what's going on there. So we ask ourselves, why is it that these people, when they have water at home, you open the shower and there's water. Why is it that they come to dip into the stream and wash and bathe in the water? It's all in the mind. Because contact is contact. The water that comes out of the shower, your body feels it the same way as the body feels it when you get into the stream. There's no difference there. Once again, the way your body perceives, right, and with your mind together, the way that your body perceives water as it touches your body, as it comes out of the shower, is the same way that your body perceives it when you dip into the water in a stream. So what's the difference? It's in the mind. Because the mind thinks that I am now in a stream. Whereas at home, the mind knows that I am in a shower. And then they have all sorts of drushti. That people have said, People have said that going out into the stream, you know, taking a dip in the water, being with nature, you know, these are all very nice and lovely things to do. So that's how you should spend your weekend. So what do people do then? They may even be coming from, you know, very far away, maybe several kilometers away. Wake up in the morning, pack their lunch, right, bring their children together, get someone to look after the dog, right, do all that, prepare themselves, fuel the tanks, and drive maybe sometimes tens of kilometers to come to the stream, and then they get out and they get into the water, do exactly what they would have done if they were at home, right, shower, and then wipe themselves, get back into the car. Oh no, they have to eat first, right? Your packed lunch. It's different, isn't it? When you're at home and sitting around the dining table, that's one experience, isn't it? Yeah, but when you're out there by the stream, after you had a dip in the water and then have your food, that's a different experience, isn't it? Yes. Says who? Does your body say that? No. But look at what people put themselves through. I can understand this because I can relate to this very well. You know, I used to be, a few years ago before the Dhamma, I was an animal. A few years ago before the Dhamma, on our way just about anywhere, if I spotted a pool of water, even from the side of my eyes, we would not proceed from there forward. We had to stop. It mattered not how urgent we were, how quickly we had to get somewhere. My father had to stop. We had to get out. I had to go dip in the water. I'd have a wash, just enjoy myself in the water and get back into the car, and then we'd go. I was a pain in the backside. So I can relate to that. I know exactly what they're going through. Even when we used to come down to Sri Lanka from, you know, time to time, once a year at the very least, we'd book a resort somewhere. Right? So my wife and I, we'd book a resort where there would be water. I love water, just being in water, dipping myself in water and just, you know, just relaxing. And it had to be somewhere there was a body of water. So I was a nature kind of person. I really loved that. But today I ask myself, what was all that about? It was all mental. Because in the physical world, all there is water. The water in your stream is that. The water that comes out of the shower. It's the same water. It's the same water. But it might be that, you know, you've even designed your homes in such a way. Now, in certain hotels that we used to stay at, right, they have this, I can't remember what they're called now. You must help me here. Are they called open showers or something? Yes? Open showers. So basically they've designed the shower rooms where, so there are glass doors to begin with, and then also it's open sky. Yes? Correct me if I'm wrong. Open sky? Ah, there you go. So it was an open sky shower, so you could look up at the sky and feel like you are with nature. It was simply a feeling. Just a feeling. At home you had the shower and you didn't have to pay anything but the water bill to have that shower. But when you wanted an open sky shower, you had to go and reserve a hotel room and drive up there and then get in there and then have that shower. somehow that shower is a different shower. I can relate to that because I've been there, done that, and bought the t-shirt. So I know this. This is why I have pity for people who still do that. I have sympathy. You know, it's all a creation in the mind, ladies and gentlemen. If it were real, I wouldn't mind that. I'd have no problem. This is all a creation of the mind. The mind, you know, just take sight, for instance. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I encourage you to watch yesterday's sermon if you get some time over the course of next week. The one we did on Saturday, yesterday, at the monastery, where we explained about how frequencies work and how they produce light, and how there's some light in the visual spectrum, and therefore how sight is not something that's in the outside world, but is something that the mind perceives. Right? We went through a lot of detail to explain that. So if you're interested and if you have some time, I encourage you to go back and watch that. But you remember from our previous conversations, I was asking you whether the sight is in the pen. Here you only have the four basic elements. What do the four basic elements look like? We don't know. We don't know what the four basic elements look like because they're not meant to look like anything. Nothing has a look. You know, when you tell someone, you look nice. No, you know, people don't have looks. What is there are just the four basic elements. They're not meant to be looked at. You know, looks is not something, is not a characteristic of objects. But you say it looks nice, it looks bad, it smells nice, right? We say these things, don't we? It tastes nice. But these are not characteristics of objects. This is simply how the mind perceives the world in which it lives. What you don't know is you live in a matrix. You live in the world that you create. This is purely an imaginary world, ladies and gentlemen. This person that you see is sat next to you, they're not really there. But don't slap them to check that. What there is purely the four basic elements and a chitta that arises and passes away. But that chitta might think that it's a human being. So therefore, if you slap them, they might slap you back. That's all there is. So you can imagine how I must feel today when I see people come in and dip into the stream and, you know, they spend the whole afternoon there. And I think to myself, if only they'd driven another half a kilometer. That they don't do. They stopped half a kilometer short of the oasis in the middle of the desert. Well, what can I do besides having sympathy towards them? You know, young people, most of them young people, young men and women, you know, they must have worked the whole week, maybe the whole month, toiled themselves, working day and night. Right? And then, when a weekend comes along, a long weekend comes along, what do? They pack some lunch, they go to the stream, they take a dip in there, they spend the afternoon, eat the food that they brought, and then they come back home. If they'd driven another 200 meters, another 300 meters, they would have realized the truth. But alas, see, they're 200 meters short of merits. That's the thing. Your merits can get you all the way from here to Ingiriya. But they don't have the merits to get from the stream, which is 200 meters from the monastery. So next time you come to the monastery, just look. It's on the left-hand side, on the way there. And on the way back, it's on the right-hand side. You'll see people getting into the streams, right? Parking up. Now, usually on a Sunday, there are many cars lined up. Sometimes tens, six, seven, eight cars. Young children, adults, all sorts. all because they believe happiness comes in the object. You know, that's why you are happier when you eat out at a restaurant. Don't you enjoy that experience, going out and eating at a restaurant? It makes you, somehow you feel like, you know, there's something special about it. But there's actually nothing special about it. It's just food. What do you have in your food? You have carbohydrates. You have proteins. You have lipids. What else? You have vitamins. You have minerals. These are the things you have in your food. What about if it's a takeaway? Then what do you have? If you cook it at home, then what do you have? It's the same thing. But why do people pay more? To take away? To dine in? They pay more because they believe that somehow when this comes from the restaurant, that brings us happiness. I get the fact, I get this part of it, right? If it's, when you take away, you don't have to cook. That I get. Understand. That I understand. When you go out and eat at a restaurant, you don't have to cook. If you take away, you don't have to cook. That much I can understand because cooking is fun, isn't it? That I get. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the pleasure that you derive from eating food that is not cooked at home but elsewhere, either brought into you, sometimes, you know, your next door neighbor, they cook something and somehow it seems more pleasurable to you. This is all because of ignorance. When you are ignorant about this, the fact that objects bring you happiness, what has happened to you in your lives happens. Today you are trapped. You know, you've built a network around yourselves. You've built yourselves a network around yourselves out of which you now cannot come out. It's a net that you have built for yourselves. It's like the a spider builds a net for itself and then it's a web for itself and then it's stuck in that web. In the same way, when you believe that objects bring you happiness, ladies and gentlemen, what you do is you build a web around it. And then once you build that web, now you can't get out of it. See, you have a home now. You have a house. Right? So even if you go, if you wanted to travel, you have to come back, don't you? Because you have a house. You can't just go and, you know, pick yourself up and go and put yourself down anywhere in the world. You have to come back. You're anchored now to some things in life. You're anchored to your children. Even if you go and spend the weekend away with your friends, you still have to come back home because you have anchored yourself to the things that you have attached and the web that you have built. You can go and spend your time with your friends, but you have to come back to your husband, you have to come back to your children, you have to come back home, you have to come back to your work. Because this is the web that you have weaved for yourself. Like a spider who might wander away a little bit to look for prey, but then they have to come back. This is the world that you have built for yourself. I don't have to be that way. I don't have a house I have built for myself. I don't have children I have to come back to. I don't have a spouse I have to come back to. There is nothing I have to come back to. What that means is, when I go, I'm gone. I mean it in a metaphorical sense. But when you go, you have to come back. Because you have built a web for yourself. So if you can come out of that web, not physically, mentally, if you can come out of that web, then when you go, you can be there. When you go somewhere else, you can be there. In other words, when you're gone, you're gone. Even when you're here, if I start talking to you about your house, right, if you forgot to check the doors before you left, forgot to check lock the windows before you left, you know, these, I can instigate fear in your mind simply by making you doubt whether you have locked your windows and your doors and you turned off the cooker. I can make you uneasy. It's all possible. Because there's something you have to go back to. But you know, you were born to be free. Do you know that you were born to die? Have you forgotten that? People seem to have forgotten that. Have you forgotten? Answer. Have you forgotten that you were born to die? How many years did you plan on living in this world? Let's give you 70. Okay? When did you build your house? When did you finish building your house? Still building, Swami Hansen? Let's say you finish building your house at the age of 40. Okay? Finish building your house at the age of 40. If you are due to go at 70, how many more years do you have to live in that house? 30. How many years did you build your house to last? 170. Why? Because you weren't born to die, were you? You know, we all die, but we think we don't. The one thing that we are all going to do, we so conveniently forget. We so conveniently ignore. I know that I'm going to die. I don't know about you, alright? I know that I'm going to die, so like my life depends on it, I'm preparing for that, even right now. Can't you see? You know, when I'm dead, they're going to wrap me up in this. This is what they're going to wrap me up in. When you die, that's not what you're going to be wrapped up in. I'm prepared for death. I'm even clad in what I'm going to be wrapped up in when I die. You? Have you bought that dress yet? Is it in the wardrobe? It's not, is it? No, someone else will worry about that, right? Yes. So someone else has to worry about your death. Someone else has to worry about your death, not you. That's the problem. You're just worried about living. You're not worried about death. So if you're not worried about death, then you're not worried about what happens after death. Whereas I'm always thinking about death. That's why I'm always so happy. But you think if someone's always thinking about death, then they have these morbid thoughts and they're always gloomy and so discontent and so unhappy and so frustrated? No, ladies and gentlemen, if you're always thinking about death, you're very happy. Because if you're always thinking about death, then you have no expectations. And if you have no expectations, then you're happy. But when you don't expect death, now you expect things to last. When you expect things to last, now you live in constant fear. Because you have an expectation that they must last. But of course, things don't always last. They all have an expiry date. And that day when it comes, now you're in grief. Now that's a shocker for you. You're shocked. Isn't that why when you get news that, you know, someone in the family has passed away, you are shocked? You not had this experience? Someone gives you a call and says, I'm really sorry to inform you that so-and-so has passed away. What? And you're shocked. You think ever if you inform me that someone in my family has passed away, I'm going to go, what? Mother's passed away? You think I'm going to be shocked? No. She was born to die. My father was born to die. Everyone I know was born to die. That doesn't shock me. But say someone brings you and says, you know, this lady, she's 250 years old. I'm like, what? Not dead yet? That would shock me. Everyone's born to die, and there's this woman who's 250 years old and she's not dead yet. That's a shocker. But the funny thing is, though, like, now, these days apparently you can even book your coffin in advance. You can go and check whether it's nice, you know, plush velvet, right? There's the premium package. You can choose, you can pick your flowers, you can pick the inner lining, you can pick the wood, the timber, you can pick that. You can even pick the hinges, whether they're gold-plated, the handles, whether silver-plated, gold-plated, diamond-crusted. You can pick all that. And the service that you get, right, at your funeral, you can pick all that. Isn't that wonderful? See, people forget that when they're dead, they're dead. That they forget. Because mentally, they're not prepared for death. Even after they're dead, they think they still live on. So therefore, they want for that experience to live on. So therefore, they have to pick all these things before they die. Otherwise, what if they disrespect my dead body? What if they disrespect my dead body? I mean, just think about, you know, these days, now, at our monastery, every 4 months we have a blood donation campaign, right? So, in the blood donation form, they ask you whether it's okay to take your organs once you're dead. Yeah? I always wonder why they ask you that. I don't know, it really baffles me. Why should anyone ask me whether they should take my parts of my body when I'm dead? Like, who cares? Why? If they don't, isn't Mother Nature going to take it back? Huh? If I don't give my consent to give my, say, I don't know, what parts can you give when you're dead? Give me one. Eyes. Okay. Right? If I don't give my, the pupils, right? What do they give? The lens. Which part of the eye can you give? The pupils. Okay. The cornea. Thank you. So, say you have consented to donate your corneas. What if you didn't consent? Now it's yours to keep forever. Huh? Isn't nature going to take it from you anyway? What if they lock you up in the coffin? And they iron bolt it. So that Mother Nature can't get to you. Does it not start festering in a couple of days? And then go back into the earth 3 months later? So why ask me? Why ask me about something I have no choice? I don't get that. I get it. I mean, I get it. I'm not stupid. Although I look it. I get it. Right? I get it. I understand why there has to be a consent form, right? Because it's because the surviving partners, family, friends, right? They're going to have a concern about, you know, these parts being taken away, because, you know, when they look at the full body, they think, you know, that's my cousin, that's my brother, that's my sister, that's my father, that's my mother. Don't you take away their corneas. You know, if I urge all of you, if you can, right, consider this. When you are dead, you can no longer donate any part of your body. That donation, you know, even if someone takes a part of your body after you're dead, that does not give you any merits. But if you can at least consent to parts of your body being taken while you're still alive, you can earn merits out of it. Because you're doing a merit in advance. You can earn merits out of it while you are still alive. Because after you are dead, If someone comes and takes a part of your body, that's not merit to you. That's like when you're looking away, someone comes and takes something that belongs to you. Is that merit to you? Yes, that's what I'm saying. Do it while you're still alive. So, where you have the option, right, where you, because you have a choice, right, you have been given the option to make that, give your consent to parts of your body being taken for, you know, to help another living human being live a comfortable life, right, and heal them. Give that consent while you can. Because even after you're dead, they will still take it. So your consent matters not. Right? Either the eye bank will take it, or nature will take it. Now you have no choice about that. But while you are still alive, you can make that donation by giving your consent and earn merits out of that. So that's just a side point. So I invite all of you to consider consenting to taking whatever part of your body can be used. And I know that now when I was a lay person, I had consented to my whole body being taken for medical studies. Like in the universities, they use corpses to teach students on how to do sutures and study the anatomy. So I'd already done that because, you know, that in my mind, I'd already done the deed. Hadn't I? In my mind, I'd already done the deed. So I invite and encourage all of you, right, while you still can, while you still have the choice, do it. Because there's going to come a point where you have no choice, but they're going to take it anyway. So you can't earn merits out of that. Anyway, that's just food for thought. Live knowing that you were born to die. Once again, live knowing that you were born to die. Because that is the only definite about your lives. You may have, some may not have. Whatever. Some may have an education, others may not have an education. Some may have 3 square meals a day, others may not. Some may have a mother for the most part of their lives, others may lose their mother when they're 5 years old. We all have things that others may not have. But there's one thing that we all have to face, and that is death. In death, we are all united, aren't we? But that is the one thing that we tend to forget all the time. All of the time. So live a life knowing that you're going to die, and there's going to be something that's going to happen after you're dead. Whatever merits you have earned, you can take with you when you're gone. And nothing more. This is why I always encourage, I ask you to think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Especially, you know, now these were things that I thought for myself when I was a layperson. Today I don't have anything to give besides the Dhamma, right? So my plans have changed. But it used to be that I had planned my life whereby I wanted to acquire wealth, and during the latter part of my life, because by then I had understood that to take with me, I have to give it. I realized at one point that if I had just kept saving up my money, my wealth, in my bank account, on the day I die, I take nothing of that with me. I take none of that with me, because I haven't given, I've just hoarded. The way I planned my life was, towards the latter part of my life, if I was going to be alive and have a natural death, towards the latter part of my life, I wanted to give everything away, so not for Nibbana. By that point, I hadn't come across Nibbana, but I had come across the fact that if you give, you get. Right? At that point, I'd come to the realization that towards the latter part of my life, I want to be able to give everything away so that wherever I go next time, I get them back again. I mean, that's better than putting it all in the bank account and passing away. Because that's not a donation you've given to the bank, is it? It's not a donation you've given to the bank. Remember, your giving is not where the object is. Your giving is in your intention. You can keep the money in the bank, you can keep the money under your mattress. It's not about where the money is. It's not about where your property is, not where your wealth is. It's about your intention. Because in intention is what you give. With intention, you either give or you deny. It's all in the intention. So I'm sharing with you things that how I used to plan my life. As you know, when you're dead, that's it. Now whoever's left will have to decide what they're going to do with your legacy. Right? So whatever cause you believe in, if you want to give it to your children, then give it to your children while you're still alive. If you want to give it to another cause, you want to give towards cancer treatment, then give it while you're still alive. If you want to give it to the poor, give it while you're still alive. Because if you save it till the end, and if you haven't even done your last will or whatever, and then someone's going to take it anyway, and that doesn't earn you any merits at all. Because you've all worked hard to earn all this and acquire all this, I want you to be able to take it wherever you go. To take it wherever you go, you have to convert it to a universal currency. Does that make sense? And that universal currency is merits. So this is investment planning. You need a financial advisor? Well, you've got will. You've got one for yourself. Free financial advice. I'm an IFA. Independent financial advisor. So if you want to take your money with you, there's no point keeping it in a bank account somewhere and then dying. You're not going to be able to take it with you. You've worked hard to earn it. Before you die, give it. That way, you have created the intention of giving, which has created the karma, and it is now part of your vipaka. The only way to take what you have in your next birth is to draw down on it as vipaka. It's like an annuity. Right? You invest in one, and then in your latter part of your life, you draw down on that, on your annuity, right? So in the same way, or like a pension, you draw down from your pension. In the same way, you have to give so that you can get in your next life. This is advice I wish more people had. But on many occasions, I used to hear, having worked in the bank, of how many people used to die having earned, having amassed a great fortune, but they'd not had any thought of giving it to anybody, not to the church, not to the mosque, not to the temple, not to the poor people, right? Not to the government, not to the state, not to anybody. They just want to hoard, hoard and hoard. They're not going to get any of that back in the next life because they have already consumed the merits by earning that. The money that you have today are merits that you have already consumed. Remember, merits are also anicca. Once consumed, it's consumed. You can't spend the same dollar twice. In the same way, you can't spend the same merit twice. If your merit has already been converted to dollars, yen, rupees, cents, whatever, if you want to take it back again, you have to reinvest it in the bank of merits so that in your next life you can draw on that again. Unless you throw it up, it's not going to come back down again twice. Does that make sense? So think about that leisurely while you still have time. I want to show you something today. Remember, we talked about flowers and how and why you like your roses, yeah? And roses, because they're red, you like your red roses. And then I asked you the question, well, is the color red in the rose? And is that's why you like your rose? So once again, to just remind us to recap, if there are red flowers and yellow flowers, okay, simple example, red flowers and yellow flowers, there will be those among you who like the red flowers, there will be those among you who like the yellow flowers. I mean, we have flowers here today, right? If I ask you to pick your favorite flower, right, you can all do that. There may be flowers that are identical in every other way, but the only difference is the color. Then if I ask you, why is it you picked that flower, you'll say, it's because I like the color red. If you believe that redness is in the flower, now you don't want just the redness, you also want the flower. Because redness is in the flower. Yes? I'm trying to convince you that redness is not a characteristic of a flower. It's not an object. So this is where I want you to go back and listen to yesterday's sermon if you get the time over the course of the next week. That will really help you to understand this point. Redness is not in the flower. In other words, color is not a characteristic of an object. Color is how you perceive an object. Your eyes are sensitive to light waves. Actually, really, they are sensitive to electromagnetic waves. Electromagnetic waves range from, if you talk about the visual spectrum, you have red on one end and violet on the other end. If you go further, you have ultraviolet, and if you go further on the other side, you have infrared, right? So it's a bit like this. What you see here is a changing wavelength and frequency, because the velocity of electromagnetic waves is always constant. That's a C. And if you remember from physics, V equals F lambda. This is the velocity, which is the speed at which electromagnetic waves can travel. F is the frequency, lambda is your wavelength. So these two combine to give you the velocity or the speed of a wavelength. This is a constant. The speed of an electromagnetic wave does not change under any circumstances. So, that's why we use electricity. It travels at the speed of light. Light travels at the speed of light. Right? So, that is a constant. We call a C. These two things, frequency and wavelength, they can change, but if the frequency goes up, because the speed is constant, if the frequency goes up, what happens to the wavelength? It reduces. If the frequency reduces, then the wavelength has to increase. And that's exactly what's happening here. Here, you have the wavelength is longer. So the frequency is less. Whereas on this side, the wavelength is shorter. Therefore, the frequency is higher. Keeping the wave constant. It has a constant speed. We talked more about this yesterday. Okay? This is from physics. We'll remember from school. But don't worry if this doesn't ring any bells. That part was not the interesting part. Here, what I'm about to say next is the more salient point. Let's assume here you have the visual spectrum. This is the visual spectrum. What I mean by the visual spectrum, ladies and gentlemen, is an electromagnetic wave. It's called an electromagnetic wave because there's an electrical wave and there's a magnetic wave. They travel perpendicular to each other. So one's on this axis, the other's on this axis. So if you can imagine a wave going like this, okay, there are two waves that go perpendicular to each other, and the two of them together form the electromagnetic wave. Basically, this is energy traveling from one place to another. Simple as that. Can we all understand just that basic stuff? It's energy traveling from one place to another. What a wave does is, you know, a wave is essentially energy traveling from one place to another. That's all it is. Now, when I make a noise, you heard it at the back. Energy traveled from here over to the back. It traveled as a wave. So what was the medium here? Air is the medium. So as I made this noise, what I'm doing here is vibrating the air particles. The air particles just close to my hand start to vibrate. And then that vibration creates a vibration on the air particles just next adjacent to it. They start to vibrate. And then the air particles just next to it start to vibrate, and then so on. It propagates. All the way till the end of the room. That's why the lady or the gentleman right at the back of the room could hear when I did that. So this is propagation of energy. Make sense? Okay. Light is the same. Now if sound is like this, light is also the same. When I flash a light, a torch at you, the energy that is here will come to you. They come to you in the form of a light wave. Light waves are simply waves that travel from one place to another that carry energy with them. Okay? This frequency of a wave is simply talking about how frequently a packet of energy is transferred. How frequently, that's what frequency is. Now, I don't mean to be patronizing or condescending to an audience who may understand this even better than I do, because among here may be physicists and PhD holders. Mr. Daniel is a physicist from Germany, right? So he understands this stuff better than I do. I've done physics at A-levels, and this is physics from A-levels that I'm sharing with you. So this is not meant to condescend anyone or patronize anyone. It's merely meant to help anyone who's not familiar with these terms, because some might have done other subjects, right? Remember, education is not the key to happiness. One is educated in this, another is educated in sewing, another is educated in cooking, another is educated in plucking coconuts. That's all. You're educated in one thing that helps you do that thing. That's it. It doesn't mean you're happy. To be happy, you have to be educated in Buddhist philosophy. That's why we are all here today. Because our education did not make us happier. That's why we are here, to learn Buddhist philosophy. But I'm using this example to help you understand how you see things, and to convince you that it is not color that you see. Because a few people had written in from the sermon 2 weeks ago and said, "Swaminathan, sir, I really couldn't understand what you meant by the fact that color is not in the object." So that's what I'm trying to further explain to you. Now, if a wave is simply energy traveling from one place to another, let's see how you see the color. I'll take a different color for the time being. Take green, the color green. Let's just try and work out how you see this color. If we switched off all the lights and if we covered the windows, would you see it? If this room was pitch black dark, would you see this? Why not? Because you need light waves to reflect off this surface and come your way. Basically, this needs to happen. Okay? So energy, which is light rays, should bounce off this object and come your way. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you shut off these windows, put the shutters down, turn off the lights, now there is no energy in this room. There's no light energy in this room to bounce off this object and come to you, and therefore you won't see it. So the reason that you see this object, ladies and gentlemen, is because there's energy coming into contact with this object and it's bouncing off this and coming towards you. So why do you see this as green then? Reason for that is that this object is capable of taking the light that falls. Excuse me. The reason that we see this as green is because when light energy falls on this object, it absorbs a certain amount of energy and the rest of it bounces off. That rest of it is of a certain frequency. The rest of it is of a certain frequency. When that frequency, when energy of that frequency falls on your eyes, you see the color green. So, in other words, really, this is absorbing everything but green. Do you see the irony in that? This is green because it's taking everything but green. Do you see the irony in that? If this object actually absorbed light in the green spectrum, then this wouldn't appear green. It's taking everything but green. Therefore, you see green. So green is what is bouncing off this, meaning this is not green then. Simple as. Don't you get it? If this were green, then you wouldn't see this as green. Everything but green is being absorbed by this object, but the green light is bouncing off this. Yeah? So it's a bit like, say you had a bunch of colored balls. You had, say, green balls and red balls and blue balls. Okay? You throw all those balls at me. when you throw those balls at me, I only like the green balls. Sorry, I like the red balls and the blue balls, but I don't like green balls. Okay? So let's say from that side, they're throwing balls at me, and my job is to throw them back at you. Make sense? So the gentleman over there, he's throwing green balls, blue balls, and red balls at me. I like green balls and blue balls. So what do? I keep them, and I throw the green balls back at you. I keep the blue and the red, and I throw green at you. Now, what does that tell you about me? From your perspective, it seems like I have lots of green balls, and I like green, and I am green. From your perspective, it looks like I am a source of green, doesn't it? It seems like I have lots of green, and I'm giving you green because I am green. But actually, it's the contrary that is true. I actually like blue and red. I don't like green. That's why I'm throwing all the green balls back at you. So I'm anything but green, aren't I? That's why you see this as green. Okay? Right. Now, although we talk about this being green, actually, ladies and gentlemen, this is not green. This has the ability to bounce certain frequencies of energy and absorb others. The frequencies of energy that bounce off this object, when they fall on your eye, now, you remember from the colors of the rainbow, what the colors of the spectrum are. Let's start with red. Call them out if you remember. Orange. Green. No, yellow, isn't it? Yellow. Have I got that right? Yeah. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, indigo. No, it's the other way around, isn't it? Yes. This is fine. Ran family karna kolla nili beddaki. Yes. This is fine. Right. So now do you see? What you see as red is simply electromagnetic waves that are of a lower frequency but a higher wavelength. Remember the old equation? V equals F lambda. V is a constant. So therefore, when the frequency increases, the wavelength must reduce or decrease. When the frequency reduces, the wavelength must increase, right? So here, when we talk about red, let's assume this is red. At this point, to keep the velocity constant, that's why all colors come to you at once. Otherwise, you know, red has to come first, and then orange comes later, yellow comes later. That's not how it works. They all come to you at once. Because the velocity is constant. This is all light, it all travels at the same speed. Okay? What's different is here. The frequency and the wavelength. Please try and understand that frequency and wavelength are simply characteristics of energy, not light. They're characteristics of energy. What do I mean by this? Frequency of energy, what does that mean to you? Frequency of energy. How often a packet of energy is transferred? That's what it means. Remember those green balls? If I threw those balls at you, one every minute, what is my frequency? Well, it's exactly what I just said. One a minute. If I threw two at you, two every minute, right? That's the frequency. So in the same way, energy has a frequency. How often of something is what frequency is. How frequently does a bus arrive? Like that. Every so many minutes. That's what we call by frequency. So here we are measuring energy. Don't think of light for a second. Just ignore that this is light. Just think about energy. Energy is measured in joules. So when I talk about joules, don't think about red and yellow and green and indigo and violet and purple. No, put all that aside. We are just talking about joules. This is energy. So energy comes in heat, energy comes in light, energy comes in movement, energy comes in potential, energy comes in chemical energy, right? These are all forms of energy. If you consider red for a second, so is red going to come before blue or blue going to come to you before red? Which one? Which one's going to come to you quicker? They're both going to come to you at the same time. Why is that? Because the same speed. The same speed. But why is one red and the other blue? Because they have a different frequency. Or you can say they have a different wavelength. Or both. Matters not. Right? So this is energy that's coming to you at a frequency. But the funny thing is this. Here's the funny thing. Just imagine, going back to the balls analogy, imagine, ladies and gentlemen, I had a colorless ball. Okay? The frequency with which I throw the ball at you determines the color that you see. Now just think about that for a second. I'll say that again. The balls that I have, they're colorless. Okay, so initially I talked about red balls and blue balls and green balls, remember? Right, now scrap that. They're throwing at me colorless balls. What color are they? Colorless, they have no color. The frequency with which I chuck them back at you determines the color that you see. If I throw them at you, let's say at 10 a minute, you see red balls. If I threw them at you at say 50 a minute, you see green balls. Now, do the balls change color? No, they're colorless. They are colorless, but the frequency with which I throw them at you determines the color that you see. It's not in the object. This is the point I'm trying to make to you here. You're simply seeing energy of different frequencies. Energy comes in packets. Okay? So modern science will tell you that energy comes in packets. It's still being debated, this, that, way, the other. For us, we just use something that we can work with. Energy comes in packets, and they're called photons. So light energy, they come in packets, and they're called photons. So you can think of photons as a packet of energy. Do you need a chair while you wait? Okay. Super good. Daniel's here to check my homework. He's a physicist. So these are packets of energy. The frequency with which, meaning how soon I throw them at, not how soon really, how frequently, how rapidly, right? How often I throw a packet of energy at you determines the color that you see. That color only you see. It's not in the ball. That is exactly what color is. You see, ladies and gentlemen, your eye picks up electromagnetic radiation. I mean, your eyes are a fantastic piece of equipment. It's like an antenna. Now, the antenna that you have in your home television set, it picks up radio frequencies, doesn't it? Your eyes are also an antenna. It's funny to think of them like that, isn't it? And you thought they were eyes. They're not really. They're antennas. You aliens. Your eyes are simply antenna. Like your antennas at home, they and your radio, your TV, they pick up frequencies. Now, they are called ultra-high frequencies. You may have heard. UHF. You've heard VHF, very high frequency, ultra high frequencies. Right? These are the frequencies that are used to transfer radio waves, TV signals and so on. Just like they are antennas, your eyes are also antenna. They also pick up the same stuff. No different at all. They pick up the same stuff, only a different part of the spectrum. They pick up a different part of the spectrum. Now, next day I'll put on screen for you the entire spectrum And then you'll be able to see, there's the visual spectrum, and then if you go further to the right, you have the gamma, alpha, and so on. They have more penetrating power. Because they have a longer wavelength, they can go through things. That's why light cannot come through a wall, but alpha, gamma particles, they can come through a wall. That's why when you take an X-ray, right, you have to have a lead shield. Right? Any other shield wouldn't work. But a cardboard is enough to stop light waves going through. Because they have a shorter wavelength, but higher frequency. That's the way it works. That's why we have walls to, you know, if the human eye were receptive to anything more than this frequency spectrum, then these walls wouldn't do. Your bedroom walls would have to be built out of lead. The reason that you can get away with building your bedroom walls with just brick and mortar is because you only need to prevent light rays from coming in, because your antenna of the eyes can only pick up light rays. Otherwise, your next door neighbors will see everything. Again, the point I'm trying to convince you here is, it's not color that you see. You're simply seeing radiation, vibrations of energy. Frequency of energy determines whether your antenna picked them up. So what I'm trying to say here is, if these frequencies, if the electromagnetic waves that come into contact with the back of your eye are too low, so it's like a wave that's, say, this is one wave, isn't it? This is a long wavelength, but a very, very low frequency. If it's too low a frequency, these antenna would not be receptive to them. It would not respond. The converse is also true. If they had a very high frequency, they would also not be picked up by your antenna. So your antenna, what do I mean by the antenna? The receptors in the back of your eyes. These are the rod cells and the cone cells. They are antenna. They only pick up frequencies that are in the visual spectrum. If you reduce the frequency, they don't pick it up. If you increase the frequency, they don't pick it up either. So these antenna only pick up a certain frequency. Frequency of what? Energy, exactly. Not red, not green, not blue, not yellow. They're just frequencies of energy. This is just energy. Those balls, remember, when I throw the balls at you, the only reason that you see those balls as red is because I throw them at a certain rate. If I threw 50 balls per second, you see them as red. If I throw 100 balls at you per second, you see them as blue. If I threw 200 balls per second, then you'd see it as violet, and so on. Once I start throwing 500 balls at you, you don't see anything at all. Because now, your antenna are not sensitive to that range. But there are animals who see that. There are animals who do. But our antenna are not receptive to that. Now, does that convince you that it's not color that we see? It's not color that goes through our eyes. They're just electromagnetic waves of a certain frequency. Okay? But our minds interpret these frequencies as color. So I want to show you now on screen a little animation which will hopefully convince you that the color that you see is actually not out there. Okay. So, what you see on screen now, I don't know if it's bright enough. Can you manage? Alright. There's a cross in the middle of the picture, and you can see some purple dots, right, around it. Can you see anything other than the purple dot? Some of you have started to see a green dot. But see if you can find that green dot anywhere. Where is that green dot? Try and locate it. Where is the green dot? It only appears when you start looking at the cross. If you focus on the cross, now you start to see a green dot. Now, once you start seeing the green dot, it's going to be somewhere in the circle, right? See if you can look at the green dot. Try and look at the green dot. Focus on the green dot. Where is it now? It's gone. Now it's gone. So you see a green dot. I'm asking you, show it to me. And it's not there. So this green dot that you see, if the room was darker, then it would have been easier to see this. Right? I'll try and bring it next week as well. I know, whenever we are back in the main hall. So if it's a bit darker, it will be easier to see. But just focus on the cross in the middle, and you'll see that there's a green dot that's going round in a circle. But if you then try to locate the green dot, it disappears. So is there a green dot on screen? No. So how come you're seeing something that's not there? See, the green need not be on the screen for you to see it. Meaning, what you're seeing is not what's on screen. Your mind is creating green within itself. In just the same way that you're creating the purple, in just the same way that you're creating the white, in just the same way you're creating the black on either side. Your mind is perceiving green, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a green that's on the board, on the screen, sorry. This is what we call a visual illusion. It's not an optical illusion. I make that distinction purposely. It's not an optical illusion, it's a visual illusion. Because this is an illusion of the image that is created in your mind. Therefore, your vision. It's not in the optics. Optics are to do with whatever you use to create an image. Right? This is not an optical illusion. This is a visual illusion. So this green that you see is not on the board. It's not on the TV. It's not on the screen. It's something that you create in your own mind. And I have another one to show you, if you can. Yeah. So I want you to do this. Follow my instructions to the letter, as you always do. Yeah. Recognize her? This is Mohini. Now, with the ambient light, I don't know how much this is going to work, but we'll try it nevertheless. It would have been better if the room was darker. But if this doesn't work right now, when you get back home, just Google Mohini, okay? Here's what I want you to do, right? So I'll give you the instructions and try and do as I say. I want you all to look at the nose of the lady, just the nose, and keep staring at it for a little while. Keep staring at the nose for a while. Don't look away. Just keep staring at it for a while. Now keep staring and listen to what I have to say. So don't look away. What I want you to do is, on the count of three, on the count of three, I want you to close your eyes, look away from the screen, and start blinking as fast as you can. I'll repeat. On the count of three, I want you to close your eyes, look away from the screen, and start blinking as fast as you can. If you're ready, on the count of three, one, two, three. And blink as fast as you can. So you can actually open your eyes as you blink. Now, those of you who have seen something unexpected, just give me a show of hands if you saw something you didn't expect to see. Okay, so it was obviously easier to see from this side of the room because, you know, you're looking away from the light, right? So it would have been a bit difficult on the other side. What did you see? A beautiful face and more definition. And it was a full color, wasn't it?
Yes.
So you saw a picture of a girl in full color, not in these colors. So where did those colors come from? If they were not in the image, your mind created those colors.
So colors are all in the mind. That's why you are able to see colors that are not in the picture.
I think what you need to Google, if I remember right, is if you can just search for optical or even visual illusions, this will be one of them. And then you can do it on your home computer screen, right? So it's easier to do it, and it'll be more effective because you can have a suitable environment for that. But the lesson of this experiment is the color that you see on the board, on the screen, is not the color that you see, or rather, the color that you saw when you blinked your eyes is not a color that was on the screen. So how did you see a color that I didn't show to you? It's because color is not something that I need to show to you. It's not something I can show you either, because color is not something that I have to give you. You make it. I can only give you the ingredients. You make the colors up in your own mind. So that's how color works. You see, once again, all I can do is give you frequency, energy of a certain frequency, energy of a certain wavelength, energy of a certain amplitude. These are the three factors. We haven't talked about amplitude, so let's ignore that for the time being. Of a frequency and a wavelength. This is all I can give you. Energy. Your eyes interpret that energy into an electrical impulse, which goes down your optic nerve into your brain, and then your brain interfaces with your mind and interprets those electrical impulses as color. So color is not something that's in the object. That's a very good question. So the good lady is asking, would all of us have seen the same colors? Yes and no. You would have all seen the same color if all of the causes and the conditions would have been the same. Now, for example, if you're wearing glasses, some of your glasses might have a shade of a tint, right? Or maybe a particular shade. Maybe you have sunglasses on. Maybe you have, what are those glasses that? Tinted glasses. Yeah, some might have tinted glasses on. Even if you took off your glasses, right, some of you may have, you know, tiny or minor visual impairments. Maybe your eyes are of a different shape, a different texture. Maybe your retinas are different, right? So therefore, different causes might lead to a different result. But if all the causes were the same, then you would have all seen the same color. Then you would have all seen the same color. But get this. Remember, this is the mind that sees color. It's not the brain. It's not the eyes. It's the mind that sees color. And the mind is something. By mind, I mean a chitta. As you know, a chitta is something that arises and passes away. So each instance that sees blue, each instance that sees green, each instance that sees red has to see that individually on its own. So even as you keep looking at this object, although you think you're seeing a constant black or a constant green, you're not. Every chitta is seeing a slightly different green. But it looks the same, start to end, because the causes don't change that much. The environment doesn't change that much. So the ambient light in this room affects how you see a certain object, what color you see it. As day becomes noon and noon becomes dusk, then what happens? The ambient light changes. As the ambient light changes, the color you see an object, in which you see an object, that changes, right? So as the environmental factors, the environmental conditions change, the color that you see changes. Because, ladies and gentlemen, your eyes, these antenna, they're simply receptive to the energy that comes from the outside. So at noon, there's a lot of energy. At dusk, there's less energy. At dawn, there's less energy.
That's why the different lighting conditions give you a different color. Now, also think about when you heat something up. This is an example I used yesterday. When you heat something up, say an iron rod, and you hold it to a torch, and you heat it, initially it's going to start going red. Then it's going to go orange. If you keep heating it, it's going to start going blue. And if you switch off the torch, it's going to go dark again. What's going on here then? So where's the red? Where did the red come from? Did the torch give redness to the rod? Did it give orangeness? Did it give blueness? No. All that's going on is the torch is a source of energy. The torch is a source of energy. Question, ma'am? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely, yeah. So the evening sky and the colors that you see, right, because there are various particles in the air, right, and then when sunlight falls on that, different frequencies of sunlight, as they fall on the particles that's in the air, you know, it bounces off those particles and then they come to your eye. Remember, your eyes are antenna. So they just pick up energy, waves. And depending on which frequency of energy wave it picks up, you interpret as a different color. So as you heat something up, the example I was using earlier, as you heat something up and hold a torch to it, you are simply transferring energy. That's all. What is heat after all? Heat is just energy. You can think of heat as simply how rapidly something's bouncing up and down. Actually, heat energy is ultimately kinetic energy. So those who have done physics, you remember, heat energy is ultimately kinetic energy. What is kinetic energy? Energy to do with motion. So when you heat, why does something melt when you heat it? I know today is a physics lesson. But this is all to help you better understand that what you're attached to is not in the outside world. You create it in your mind. That's the point I'm trying to get to. When you heat something up, why does it melt? Because when you heat something up, exactly, when you heat something up, you're giving it kinetic energy. The particles that make up that object start moving. And when they start moving rapidly and they start moving a lot, now the bonds between them start breaking. And therefore, the space between those molecules increases. Therefore, when there's a lot of space between two molecules, it is no longer a solid, it is a liquid. Increase the space further, it becomes a gas. That's how you have a melting point and a boiling point to anything. Yeah? But if you take an iron rod and if you heat it, you're simply transferring energy. These are packets of energy. So when these packets are absorbed by the object, it keeps some of it and it bounces off the rest of it. The rest of it that comes out of it, your antenna pick up. And if it's in the visual spectrum, you see it as red. So when it's not red, is it not another color? What color is it when it's not red? So we are heating an iron rod. You're holding it to a torch. Okay? So this is the flame. This is where red begins. Okay? What about when it's giving off these frequencies of energy? There's still energy, but your antenna don't pick it up. That's why you don't see any color of it from it. So couldn't there be something over here that's not giving out energy of a certain frequency and therefore you can't see it? Can't you see Sam? See, I've brought a Deva with me. And over here is a Brahma. Over here is another spirit. And there is a demon. Now prove to me that they don't exist. Now how can you say that they don't exist just because we don't see them? You know, we only see a tiny portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. A lot of it we don't see. When you hold your remote control to your TV screen at home, right? You press a button on it, it's actually transferring electromagnetic wave to your TV set. But you don't see it. But that doesn't mean it's not doing it. In fact, if you held an object in front of, so take a thick book, you know, take a dictionary and hold it next to the remote control where you have the transmitter and then hold it to your TV set, it's not going to work. That's why you'd normally have to hold it in a straight line. That's why you have to hold it in a straight line, because electromagnetic waves, they travel in straight lines. They don't travel everywhere, they just travel in a straight line. So just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. So how can you say then, with our very limited ability to see things, how can we say that devas don't exist? How can we say that brahmas don't exist? How can we say that angels don't exist? All we can say is what we see exists. What we cannot see, who knows? See, this is why I say, the more I learn, the more I realize that what I know I can write a book up with, but what I don't know we can fill a library up with. The more you learn, the more you realize how much you don't know. Madam? All see the same color. Let's switch that off, please. It's too loud. This fan, yeah. So the lady is asking, how come we all see the same color? Here's my point. How do you know you're all seeing the same color? How do you know you're all seeing the same color? You know, I show you this one fine day and I call it green. Whatever color you see, now you have learned that it's called green. Okay? So the next day, I show you this. Are you going to call it green? No, this is the first time you're seeing this. And today I say this is black. So whatever color you see, you now give it a label black. Right? So now, when I say, everyone show me green, you're going to show this. But one might see green, another might see blue, another might see yellow, another might see red, another might see orange. Who knows? How can you check whether the color you see is the same color someone else sees? You can't, right? How can you? I don't know whether you get the point that I'm trying to make. I'll try again. I see some blank faces. I'll try again. I show you this. This is the first time you're seeing this color, okay? And I tell you this is the color green. When you see this, your eyes work. Now, okay, think about this for a second. Let's say half of this room had a colored glass on. Let's say you had red colored glass on. You had a bare eyes. Okay, no colored glasses. You are looking at it through your bare eyes, naked eyes. You had a red colored glass on. Now, the day I show you this and say this is green, what do you think is green now? What you think is green is what they think is blue. Okay? And what you think is green is... what you think is green is green. Well, this is green for you, but because they've been wearing glasses, they wore glasses when we did this experiment, they think, say, let's assume that when you wear red glasses, you see green as blue. Now you see the color blue when I show you green on this side of the room. But this side of the room, you see this through your naked eyes, so therefore you pick this up as green. So next time I ask them to show me green, they're going to bring this. Of course they'll bring this because they are always looking through their glasses. But what if they took off their glasses and then I asked them to show me green? They're not going to show me this. Then they'll show you blue or some other color. Now, why do I say it this way? The reason I explain to you this way is there are a million factors that determine how you perceive color. Okay? So therefore, it's impossible to say whether the color that you see is the same color that someone else sees. But if you're both pointing at the same thing, whatever you see, you will say, is that color? And the other person will also agree that it's the same color. Now, it matters not what you perceive. You've both come to a convention that this color is the color that you've come to agree with. So then it matters not what color it is that you see. Because as the conditions change and the causes change, the way you perceive color changes. I'll give you another analogy. Let's assume we all go to the zoo. Okay? We all go to the zoo. And in the zoo you have... So this is the first time we're going to a zoo. In the zoo, you have these animals. That looks like a brontosaurus. I meant to draw a giraffe, okay? So, they're inside the cage, in their cages, and here it's got a label. Tiger. Okay? They're cleaning the giraffe's cages, so they've temporarily transferred the giraffes to the tiger's area. And then, on the other side, you have tigers. These are tigers. Okay? What are they? Thank you. They're tigers. So tigers, they are shifted to the giraffes. Right. Now, I can't take all of you at the same time to the zoo. I can only take half of you. Okay, so we'll take this half of the room to the zoo. We go on a trip. And then, there's no tour guide. You just have to walk, read the boards, and then come to learn that it is what it is. So people on this side of the room, when we go to the zoo, you're going to keep walking down the zoo and then you see, right, these things, they're called tigers. All right? You see these things, they're called giraffes. Okay? So now you come back and the following day, we take you lot. This time round, they've put them into their respective cages. So today, now they're back in their respective cages. So when you lot go to the zoo, you see tigers and you see giraffes. Okay? Now, the two of you have to come together on some activity. And I ask you to draw a tiger. When I ask you to draw a tiger, what are you going to do? You are going to draw these things. They are going to draw giraffes. If I ask you to draw giraffes, then this lot are going to draw tigers, and you are going to draw giraffes. Okay? The problem here is, when we went to the zoo, the labels were different. They had the wrong label on. So, although you understood tigers to be these things, beasts on four legs, perpendicular to the surface, and these things as giraffes, this side of the room got it the other way around. this is where a confusion would be. This confusion you can resolve. Why can you resolve this confusion? You can resolve this confusion, ladies and gentlemen, because you can both see the same thing. You see? This confusion you can resolve. Because all you got to do is the two of you, one from this room, one from this side, if the two of you go to the zoo at the same time, now you can say, hang on a second, I thought these things were tigers or giraffes. No, they are giraffes, aren't they? They're tigers, aren't they? But I thought, you thought, he thought, she thought, and now you can put the right labels on and come to an agreement and a conclusion. Okay, we got it wrong, you were right. Now we understand that these are tigers and these are giraffes. This you can resolve because these are objects in the outside world. Get it? You can resolve this confusion because these are objects in the outside world. Color. Color. Color is not in the outside world. Color is in the mind. How do you resolve it? There's only one way you would be able to do that. You've got to be able to read the other person's mind and actually get a mental impression. Actually, it's like telepathy. You would have to be able to read the other person's mind, and when they see color, when they see yellow, you have to be able to see what they see is yellow. And then you would be able to say, whoa, that's not yellow, that's red. That's the only way in which you'd be able to do that. Because color, this is a further evidence that color is in the mind. If you get the wrong color, if you give it the wrong name, you can't correct it. Because you can't reconcile that, because the two of you are in your own worlds. These worlds are individual worlds. They are separate worlds. Whereas here you're talking about physical things on the outside world. The same applies for music. The same applies for music as well. Or say the level of sound. When someone says, not the amplitude, let's say, when you balance sound. So when you say, let's say someone setting up this room to have the optimum sound effect, right, the sound balancing, they're doing setting it for optimum effect. Someone sets the room up and then they leave. Another one comes in and then they figure, say you've changed the setting, someone else comes into the room and they change the setting. And then they think that this is the right setting. Now the two of them have a different mental image of what the right amount of sound is. It's not a familiar example to you, right? So scrap that. It's rather easier to take an example that you can relate to. We go through this every day because we have to set up audio at the monastery for various events. So if you have experience of this, you'll understand. So scrap that example. This would be a better example. You can understand this because all you have to do to clear this misunderstanding is for two of you to go to the zoo at the same time. But how can one of you step into this person's mind? How can you step into their mind and actually see when you hold this, when I hold this, if you could see what they're seeing right now, then you'd be able to say, that's not the same color that I am seeing. To answer the lady's question. If you could see what they are seeing right now, then you'd be able to say, that's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a different color. I'm seeing a different shade of that color. If they could see what you're seeing, then they'd be able to say, that's not the same color that I see. I see a different shade. But you can't come to that conclusion. You can't have that discussion because seeing is something that happens in the mind. And you can't share with the other person, what's in your mind. How can you? Madam? To see what? Yeah, so telepathy is a... I have no personal experience of this, but it is said that telepathy is the ability to read another person's mind, or actually read something at a distance, meaning another mind. Okay? So, those who have telepathic skills, I presume, are able to tell what the other person's thinking of. meaning you can be sensitive to another person's thoughts. So by being sensitive, I mean you perceive exactly what they're perceiving. If you are able to perceive exactly what they're perceiving, then of course, that makes sense. See, now one final answer to the good lady's question. It's a very good question, madam, and one I'm struggling to answer, meaning it's a very good question. Just take, I'll come back to you. Just take an emotion. That's a good example, I think. Take an emotion, love. When someone walks up to you and says, I love you, it induces emotion within yourself as well, if you also feel the same way about the other person. But how do you know whether the two loves are the same? How can you tell? How can you tell whether someone loves you the same way you love them? How do you tell? You can say these things. I gave him 3 chocolates, he gave me 2. That you can tell. I got him a gift, he got me none. He gave me a card, I gave him none. These things you can tell because they are in the outside world. Aren't they? Cards in the outside world, chocolates in the outside world, birthday gifts in the outside world. But if that is meant to represent love, and then you ask another person, do you love me just as much as I love you? How on earth can they answer that question? Because they can't tell how much you love them. How do they know? How many units of love is that? How can they tell? Isn't that why you're always living suspiciously about the other person? Isn't that why you always have doubts? Does he really love me just as much as I love him? Does she really love me just as much as I love her? These questions always linger in your mind because you can't check that. To represent love, you have chocolates and you have teddy bears and you have birthday gifts and you have Valentine gifts and you have cards and flowers and all sorts, right? Why do you need them? Go on, give me an answer. Why do you need them? Because you can't share with the other person the emotion of love, because an emotion is a purely mental thing. Only you know how much you love another person. They will never know that. Never. But you try to express it. You try to express it by giving them gifts. You keep on giving them gifts in the hope that they might understand how much you love them. But it might be that that does not work for them. For them, gifts is not what they need. You are giving them a different kind of gift. Because the way that they like to show love is a different way to how you like to show it. So, two lovers always have this problem. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I don't know enough about telepathy to answer that question, right? How when you try to phone someone else knows that you are, or they were trying to call you at the same time. I don't know how telepathy works because it's not my field of expertise. That could be coincidence, but I'm not going to say that there is coincidence because it would be wrong. If I don't know enough about telepathy, how am I to judge that it's coincidence? It's possible that two people can have the same thought at the same time. For example, what is this? Yeah, there you go. How come you all said that at the same time? It's because you all had the same thought at the same time. Meaning, same causes, same effect. That's the way I understand the world. If two of us feel the same way about something, it's not a miracle. It's the same causes. Cause and effect. I don't know enough to comment on that. Madam, you had a question at the back? Yes. Brain what, sorry? Dominant, right. Yes, exactly. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. In fact, there are some visual illusions. I'll bring a few another day. There's a very popular one. I think it was an internet sensation many years ago, about a dress. It went viral, apparently, before my time, but
I later got to know about it, that there's a lady in a dress. Some people think that she's clad in purple or blue, others think that she's clad in yellow. It's the same picture, but people see a different color. So that might explain what the lady's explanation might attribute that, how different, if you are left dominant, right dominant. Because, you know, this dominance that we talk about, that's a different in the environment, isn't it? Different causes. That's why if you have the same causes, then it'll always be the same result. But who are we to say that it's always the same causes? You know, how do we know that my eye is the same as your eye? My left eye is different to my right eye. How can we say that we both see the world the same way? Right? Some of us wear glasses, others don't. Your left eye is different to your right eye. Then you have myopia and dystopia. Dystopia? And utopia. I'm just making. Then you have long-sightedness and short-sightedness. You have colorblindness, right? You have all these things. So how can you actually say that two people say the same color? It's virtually impossible. Possible, virtually impossible that two people actually say the same thing, because ultimately, here's the reason, color is not out there. The net effect of all of these factors is the color, and that's created in the mind. Because it's created in the mind, there is no way for us to compare whether it is the same color that we see. Just like when I say I love you, how do you know how much I love you? You don't. You can't. And we never can. Unless, perhaps, one day, you can read my mind. Right? Maybe telepathy is just that. I've heard that the Buddha could read another's mind. Right? So much so that he could scan another being and figure out how much defilements they have. It's called the Asya Anusayanyane. How much defilements they have left within them. And based on that, he would give a discourse to cleanse the mind of those defilements. We've missed the boat, unfortunately. If the Buddha were here today, you need not have every Sunday sermons. You only need one sermon. He would look at you, he would scan you, he would give you the sermon and say, that's it, go with your practice, you need not come to the sermons again. But that boat we all missed. So today, we just keep on listening to the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, and, you know, making the best of what we have. But this is not blind faith. You know, it is with wisdom, as you've understood today. Right? There's a science behind this. I'm using science to help you understand these concepts, because most people today in society, they have taken refuge in science. They have given up their refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, and they have taken refuge in science. But what science doesn't understand is that these are all manifestations. For that, you need the Buddha's teaching. Science talks about entities. Even when they say, these four legs and this plank of wood together make the table, science doesn't teach you that this is a manifestation. What science teaches you, this is a table. This is an entity of a table. And therefore, we are always used to seeing the world as fully formed things. So when something breaks, we think that that thing is broken. When something falls apart, we feel that that thing has fallen apart. When something dies, we feel that that thing has died. We feel that there are entities in this world that collapse and are destroyed and are formed and decay and die and so on. That is because we see ourselves as entities. This is the self-based view of Sakkayaditti. Once you come out of Sakkayaditti, then you begin to realize that all there is Yankinchi Samudaya Dhamma, Sabbhantan Nirodha Dhammanti. Hetum Paticca Sambhutam, Hetu Bhanga Niruchati. There are no entities, all there are causes manifesting themselves as results, and when those causes cease to exist, the result ceases to exist. That is the crux of Buddhist philosophy. All this, ladies and gentlemen, is not to give you a physics lesson, because I am not qualified to teach you physics. I am not a physics teacher. I am not even a teacher. All I want to do here is to make use of some of the things that we have learned, thanks to my teachers, thanks to our teachers who took great effort and pain to teach us these things. And some of you in the audience will be familiar with some of these concepts, to help you
bridge that gap between your understanding of science and the Buddha's teaching of how the mind works. Most of us understand the distance between the journey from object to brain, but there's a mind that has a key part to play. If the mind did not want to see, there wouldn't be a brain, there wouldn't be the optic nerve, there wouldn't be an eye, there wouldn't even be objects. The whole world is created because the mind wishes to see. And what does the mind wish to see? The mind wishes to see sights. Unfortunately, the ignorant mind thinks that sight is a part of an object, is an intrinsic characteristic of an object. Therefore, when the mind wishes to see sights, it believes that it needs to acquire the object, because it thinks that the sight belongs to the object, but it doesn't, because the sight is a creation of the mind. Once you begin to understand that, your attachment to objects ceases. Now you are able to give up your attachment to physical objects. But that does not take away your attachment to sight. That's still there. Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, the attachment that you have to that sensual world that you create within your mind, that attachment will still remain. But the expectation that those sensual impressions are delivered to you from the material objects, that is ignorance. That ignorance can be eradicated by understanding what I have taught you today, or what we have learned today. So, go back and contemplate on what we have discussed today. As I said, if you can, watch yesterday's sermon as well, because we went into a little bit more detail as to what some of these things are, some of the basics that we discussed here today. But if all of this was just went over your head, and you now you're thinking, my God, do I need to understand physics as well to understand the Buddha's teaching? That is not so. Okay? Because physics may not be some of your cup of tea. It's fine. Maybe physics was what you hated at school. It's okay. For those who understand physics, this will be helpful. If you don't, it's okay. Another day we'll take another example. That's all. Ultimately, it's not the physics lesson we need to understand. It's the fact that causes come together to manifest. If you get that part, then you're a winner. I have a request to make from all of you. Myself and all the members of the Mahasangha, we are making a huge investment in your Nibbana. This is an investment that goes beyond words. It's a priceless investment. I have understood the value of your life. I want you to understand the same. Don't take unnecessary risks with anything. If you were careful before you crossed the street, before you came across the Dhamma, be extra careful now. Because your life is a lot more valuable than it was. You see, today, I'm making an investment in you, each and every one of you individually. So I want my investments to yield results. That might sound selfish, but I'm selfish on your behalf. I want these investments to yield results. I was always a person like that. I wouldn't do things just for the sake of it. If it's not going to give me results, I would just let it go and go and mind my own business. I would not even invest 5 minutes in an individual if I felt that that person is not going to make use of it. Even the friends that I associated, I only kept close associations with friends who I knew I could make an investment in them and they could make an investment in me. Not monetary investment, something useful to come out of our being together. I feel now that about you. So when you cross the street, be extra careful. Don't get into fights with anyone. Don't get into arguments with anyone because it's not worth it. What if they stab you? What if they hit you? What if they have a grudge against you and take it over you? Don't get into any of those things. Even for the purpose of entertainment, Right? If you want to go sightseeing, if you want to go and dip into the water, right? Don't take unnecessary risks. Sometimes, you know, as young people, you might like to take a risk because, you know, it's an adrenaline rush. I appeal to you to consider not doing so, because you don't have an entirety of samsara to do this. There's no guarantee that we'll come across the Buddha's teaching again. Now that you have it, protect it. Keep it safe. Don't take unnecessary risks with your life. Before you cross the street, check 10 times over. When you drive back home, ladies and gentlemen, please don't take unnecessary risks on the road. Always give way to the other person. Right? Because you don't know who the other person is. If they feel antagonized by the fact that you've just driven ahead of them, they might pull up in front of you, get out of their car, and then they might come and have a go at you. If one thing leads to the other, you don't know where these things can end. Because people are ruthless these days. They have no compassion, they have no kindness, because they have no dhamma. That's why. So don't go messing with people. Just let them have it their way. If you lend some money to someone and they won't give it back, I ask for it nicely, and if they don't, let it go. I don't know whether you can do these things, but this is my advice to you. Because if you get them on the wrong side, right, you keep asking for the money and then they get angry, and the next day what they know is they come and torch your house while you're in there, then I don't mind the house falling down, but if you die, that's a real shame. So keep yourself safe. Don't take any unnecessary risks. Stay healthy, live healthy, keep healthy, and look after yourselves. Because we are doing a project here. This project is a timely project. We call it a project because when your life ends, this ends. Yeah? So there's a start date whenever we started, and there's an end date whenever that end date is going to be. So please look after yourselves. I'm making a huge investment. The Mahasangha is making a huge investment on your behalf. I need you to take it seriously. Okay? Thank you for being a wonderful audience. Right, let's conclude for today by transferring the merits. Okay, let us take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swaminarayana to deliver the discourse, and creating a conducive environment for all to come along, listen to the teaching, practice, and attain to their salvation. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer this message to all monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who extend their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, and those who made every effort to help make our lives more comfortable and easier to live. Those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form, may they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers and our ancestors. Those whose blood, sweat and tears have been shed to create a comfortable environment for us, and it is in their efforts today we are able to enjoy life and live it peacefully and harmoniously. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives to natural disasters such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us, noble companions to us, reminding ourselves of all that they have done for us, and out of an abundance of compassion and loving kindness, let us transfer these merits to all of them. May they all rejoice in these merits. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits that we have acquired today, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Peranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midatva, dvesha ginnen midatva, moha ginnen midatva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Raga gini niveva, desha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva. Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen siru loka siru satyoma nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.